Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Colin Tobin, whose latest book is a collection of short stories, The Empty Family. Earlier novels include Brooklyn and The Master. There are six novels, two collections of short stories, nonfiction books including Love in a Dark Time and Lady Gregory's Toothbrush, also a book reviewer, author of one play working on a second. This collection of short stories, reading that and reading Brooklyn back to back, the theme of displacement, the theme of someone being a fish out of water, comes up in virtually every story, and it seems that on some level this must be an obsession of yours.
Yeah, in a way it's the same book written twice, with the first time someone very innocent and compliant, and what the effect of emigration, of leaving Ireland, going to New York, has on somebody in the 50s, someone really who does what she's told and actually has no real experience of the world. And the other book being almost the opposite of that, where everyone in the empty family is edgy, has almost too much experience of the world, are almost too ready to assert themselves regularly. And so it's almost like two aspects of the same experience, but with very different people.
At the same time, there's also the idea that you can't go home again. This appears over and over in Empty Family. Every single time when someone returns, it's not the same. And for Eilish, it kind of is, but she also wants to go back as well.
There are two things there. One is that it is the secret history of Ireland over 150 years, that every generation has lost people by emigration. And it's a funny loss because the person is still alive in England, in America, or in Australia. You get letters. Nowadays you get texts and emails and phone calls are cheaper, Skype and all that. But what happens is strange, that the person begins to change and the person begins to lose home and gain a new one. But what I was interested in was that sort of interregnum almost. And I was noticing it in Ireland in the years of prosperity, when a lot of Chinese, Nigerians, Polish people came to Ireland, and I was noticing that they were missing both home and Ireland, that they were not experiencing Ireland as Irish people did. So I was interested in what a sensibility under those pressures would do, would look like, would feel like. So that in Brooklyn, it's somebody who really, yeah, who doesn't really assert herself. And in the stories, it's people who really are, I think, better educated, most of them, and readier for the world, but they have the same element of loss. So the second thing was that this was something that I was going through over those years, in the sense I went through it first in the 70s when I went to live in Spain, and I really wasn't the same when I came home. I may have looked the same, but I never really settled back into the country. You know, I saw the country from a different perspective. Since then, especially over the last 5 or 6 years, I've been going out of Ireland regularly, taking jobs, often on a whim, you know, in an American university, turning up, it all sounds great, and then suddenly it's Monday night, and you are in rented rooms, there's nothing to do with you, in a city that is ostensibly very nice, but actually just now, you have no connection to it. You know, the radio, the TV, the newspapers, the food, no world that you feel easy in. And you become very vulnerable. And the stories in The Empty Family, some of them are written under those circumstances on those nights when there was simply nothing else to do. And the images that came unbidden were images of dislocation, of strangeness, and of the sort of damage caused to the self by that, but also the damage the self causes the world by that.
We were talking before we went on the air that you spent time a couple of years in the Bay Area, and you recall specifically rainy nights sitting in your room in the Castro. Were any of these stories worked on at that point?
The title story was written in Palo Alto on those nights. That story, The Empty Family, was. And a lot of Brooklyn, maybe 20,000 words of Brooklyn, was written at a window on Noe and 14th when it was raining outside. The whole world was walking up and down, you know, boys holding hands, everyone seemed connected. And I was working on my book. I got quite happy working on my book, but I was glad I had it, because otherwise I wouldn't be quite sure what I would have done looking out the window. I would have felt envious or something.
The story, The Empty Family, which is one of the shortest stories of the collection, it's essentially going back to Ireland and thinking about Point Reyes, whereas, in fact, you were at Point Reyes thinking about Ireland.
Yeah. In other words, I was dreaming of home and dreaming I was there when I wasn't. It's one of the lovely things about fiction is you can do that and no one is there to stop you. But what I was also interested in was coming across in books of poetry, some of the poems are about other people, things the poet observed. And then some poems, you turn a page, are so personal, so strung out, so real. I'm talking about poems by someone like Louise Glück, by Adrienne Rich, by Sylvia Plath, you know, where you really go, oh, wow, this wasn't easy to write. And then the next poem could be about flowers or could be about a season changing. And so I thought, actually, I have no interest in writing a memoir because I don't think I could connect things or make any sense of them. But I could write down certain things that are true. So the story, you know, the reader reading it will feel, actually, this has to be true. It couldn't be made up. That as an idea in a book of stories, which is something, say, I don't notice in Hemingway. I don't notice in a lot, especially, of male writers, where you almost feel the story is there to disguise certain vulnerabilities, not to expose them. And I thought what I would do would be I'd expose them raw, make the story filled with raw nerves, and see what it would look like. I was very uneasy about it. All summer, I would wake early in the morning thinking about this book about to come out, and thinking, should I have released it? I actually felt there's something too raw about this book. Story should be more manufactured. But now I feel, actually, I think story should be less manufactured. So it's a funny sort of uncertainty.
Going from Empty Family to Brooklyn, the intensity of the Empty Family stories, particularly in the two women in the street and in the Pearl Fishers, it struck me that the characters themselves are dealing with titanic issues and trying to come to grips with their difficulties in a way that, say, Eilish in Brooklyn kind of sits back.
Yeah, I think that's the advantage of stories, in that a story can be a mood, and you can write a story in a mood, and all you must do is have the mood at the beginning and then sort of hold the mood. And so you're sort of playing with a single mood. And when that story is over, the mood is gone. With a novel, you can't do that. With a novel, I think you have to be much more controlled, and you cannot get that level of intensity into a novel. Now, there are novels that do have that level of intensity. I wanted the novel Brooklyn to be much more gentle, almost like piano music, maybe with a cello. You know, like a cello sonata, but very much chamber music and softer, that would deal with time in a way which seemed reasonable, rational, normal. In other words, that the next morning a new thing happened. It wasn't extreme. Whereas in the stories, that people do enter extreme states of mind and extreme feelings and extreme things occur to them. So it's a very different way of working, I think. And partly it is to do with the feeling, okay, I'm going to give this mood its full color. But in a novel, I didn't do that.
Did the stories in Empty Family, did they write themselves maybe in a way that Brooklyn didn't?
Yes, yeah, some of them did. Certainly the Pearl Fishers did. The Street, which is the longest one at the end, didn't. It took an awful lot of work because I had to think a lot. I had to think a lot because these were people of Islamic background in Europe. And the view of such people in Europe, in the newspapers, and I'm afraid to say in fiction, is that they're alarming. And they're going to do something terribly alarming.
To me, Colm Tobin, as I'm reading about these Muslims, in the back of my mind, it was going, why are they in Barcelona? And I kept thinking about the Madrid bombings.
Anyone would, so I knew that. I had to do a lot of thinking. If anyone thinks I'm going to invent a little bomber, an innocent little fellow who becomes a bomber, and put him into Barcelona and have him as being the bomber, well, I'm not. And what I'm going to try and do is give him a life, give him desires, give him needs, give him a way of noticing the world, so the reader slowly feels close to him. And then don't betray him or the reader by giving him an extreme adventure in terrorism. Let it flow some other direction. I mean, there are thousands of Pakistanis in Barcelona, and the Madrid bomb was done by four people. So what are the 900, you know, what are all those people thinking about? I know what they're thinking about. They're thinking about money. They're thinking about home. And they're thinking about what we might call love. But in certain moments, they're probably thinking about sex. They're all young. Therefore, give them sex. Give them worry about money. Give them jobs. Give them lives. Give them home. Give them losing home. Give them a full life. And so the story took quite a long time because I had to keep working that out so that I thought it would be convincing. And I wasn't just obviously wrong-footing the reader. And I was trying to find a way out of the story all the time to see, is there any way I can give this story a sort of sense of ease at the end? Just because they're people of Islamic background, Pakistanis, that their fate, because say certainly one of them is gay, and maybe two of them, has to be tragic, that they're found hanging somewhere or that someone beats them to death or something. What if there was some glimmer, some funny opening for them? What would that look like? So I had to work a lot on that and keep thinking.
Many of these stories, not The Street, but most of the other stories, we start in place A, we don't know where it is, and then within a page, we're inside the head of the character, and we're in place B, and the story just takes off. It's an interesting pattern.
Yeah, I didn't put too much thought into the form of some of the stories. I mean, the story that I like best is a story called The Color of Shadows, because I can see the form clearly and control it. In other words, it is set over a period of time, in a three-year period, say, between the aunt getting sort of sick and the aunt dying, and then with visits to the past along the way. But I can see the story. I could control it. I liked its shape. With the other ones, I simply let things happen and then did an awful lot of work to make sure that I wasn't... You see, if you're going all over the place with time, the possibility of going into incoherence is large because you know it. But you've got to make sure the reader does, so that you've got to leave things for a while, read them over, realize that doesn't work, take that out, put that back in, and just make it so that that clarity becomes king, because you've let yourself loose in the first draft.
That's particularly key in the story, The Pearl Fishers, because you start with someone talking about, okay, I got a phone call from this woman and I want to meet her, and then we learn about her, but the story is really about his youthful relationship with her husband.
Yeah, I was also playing with the reader slightly there in that I think the narrator is a sort of creep. And I mean, he's so smugly self-satisfied about his solitude and about his way he lives, and he just feels God, someone should give him free therapy or something. But yet, the voice I thought was strong, and what you feel in the end is that he's hiding from himself the fact that he really, really wants this guy. 30 years back, which I don't think is so uncommon, especially with gay people, where there was one guy 30 years ago, and there was one summer or there was one season where that really worked for me. You don't grow out of that.
Well, it also affects his vision of her, because he's so negative toward her, and then you realize, well, yeah, she got his man.
Yeah, that she's the cat that got the cream. And he has to imagine the two of them settling down for the evening with, you know, the radio playing in their bedroom and their two lamps and their books, and he's walking home alone. And, he consoles himself by thinking, well, at least I didn't do that, meaning that he has some sort of contempt for domesticity, for that sort of mutuality. But actually, the reader has a right not to believe him, I think.
Kind of untrustworthy, though.
Yeah, I think someone should kick him,
One story that really got me was Two Women, about Frances, the set designer. Not only was her history interesting, but I was fascinated, actually. I've never read a story about a set designer before. Did you do any research on that one?
No, I didn't. I tried to imagine what it would be like to be a set designer, and also that she's the bossiest woman alive. And I also, things like, I thought about her, if she was so difficult, directors wouldn't work with her. She's only difficult with people beneath her. She always does what a director says. She's clearly very talented. She worries deeply. If you were a director and you had someone like that working, you'd be so sure that A, she'd be carrying out your wishes, and B, that she'd be up early, working hard, missing not a trick. And that lovely feeling about somebody writing about a woman who is aged, I think she's 77 and a half in the story, and yet her energies are full and she's working away. And I mean, I was thinking about women like that who are sort of so marvelous. And then you realize there was one thing that nobody know, you know, that she will tell no one and no one will find out. And you'll see some side of her that will emerge that's much softer, much more filled with regret. You know, it was a story someone told me, but they only told me a bit of it. And it was about the end, you know, the putting on the makeup and going over to the woman and realizing who she was. But that did happen. And it was on my mind for years. And I used to love the story. She went over to her and said who she was and the woman they'd never met before. And they were the two women who had been with the same man. And now he's gone and the two of them are there. Yeah, yeah. And you know, you expect a cat fight. So you're not getting one. They're just so sad, the two of them, that they're incredibly kind to each other. And they leave it at that.
Did that scene take a long time to write, or was it? Did it just pour out?
It was very hard to know where to end the story, how further to bring it. And so I had more. I kept cutting back and back and back up so that that scene was the end. Yeah, there was quite a lot of cutting in that.
Barcelona 1975 is is very different from all the other
stories.
Yeah,
you can imagine Irish reviewers having to read it.
Because, Colm Tobin, you may be a gay person, but you're not known as a gay writer. And yet, this is a very gay story.
Yeah, I wrote it. It was published first in Spanish. I remember the agent I had in Spain at the time saying something very pointed to me about mentioning some other story that she'd loved, meaning that she hadn't loved this one. And I remember thinking that was very funny. Then I showed it to someone who said, well, why don't you publish it in English? And I said, okay, that's a good idea. Why don't I do that?
You wrote it in Spanish?
No, I wrote it in English, but I knew it was to be translated.
Oh, okay.
I mean, a lot of Spanish people would get the point that that was how people were living in Barcelona in that year. That level of chaos and that level of excitement was the city at that time. And I think every word of it's true as well. You know, I don't think I made up anything in it.
It's pure biography.
Purely. It's absolutely, I think, absolutely the case, yeah. In fact, it was published later in an anthology of nonfiction. So I loved the idea of putting it into a book of stories just to sort of muddy the waters. I published it then in the Dublin Review, and it came out in an anthology, and a lot of people in Ireland read it and were very shocked by it. I mean, in other words, I'm a very respectable person, and there's a lot of fun suddenly publishing a story like that where everybody goes, oh, my God, I couldn't sleep last night about reading that story. Are you sure you wrote it? And so I did enjoy publishing it. I mean, America's a much more open place in certain ways, but certainly in the reviews in the UK and in Ireland, people wondering, oh, should this story have been in this book? You know, was it not a piece of sort of mild pornography? The answer is, well, I don't know what pornography is. I don't think I'd be any good at it, pornography, but it's what happened.
It's explicit in a way. For me, after reading Brooklyn, knowing about and looking forward to reading The Master, dipping into Love in a Dark Time, which talks about trying to deal with one's sexuality as an artist, to suddenly kind of not merely step out a door, but to break a window and jump.
Yeah, I'm 55 years old and I operate from an unassailable position. I've been feeling both 55 and unassailable for some time, yeah.
You have a book titled Lady Gregory's Toothbrush. What is the relationship of the story Silence to that book?
What happened was that, again in Spanish, an editor, Javier Montes, was putting together an anthology of James's unwritten stories. In other words, having gone through the notebooks and finding that all these stories were unwritten. You know, there's a huge amount of stuff James never wrote, but he noted down. So he sent them to a lot of people. I think I was the only non-Spaniard. The one that I noticed most was one where Henry James mentioned that a story was told to him by a Lady G. I knew that Lady G was Lady Gregory. And what I was interested in was I didn't want to write the story that she told James. But I wanted to write, why did Lady Gregory tell James a story about adultery and a woman caught in adultery? In fact, she told him two stories about it. And in fact, in her papers, there's another story that she wrote herself about it. So it was on her mind, and it was on her mind for a pretty good reason, in that she dressed, especially as a widow, and she was a widow for most of her life, she dressed like Queen Victoria and went around like Queen Victoria. But when the papers of Wilfred Scawen Blunt were opened in the 1940s, it was discovered that she'd had an affair with him within 2 years of her marriage. And when the papers of John Quinn were opened, it was discovered that Lady Gregory had written him torrid love letters as a 60-year-old woman, Oh, John, my own John, my strong John, you know, letters. That's what you don't want anyone to see. And that, in fact, inside this little Lady Gregory was a vivid sexual presence. I was very pleased about this. It was interesting to write. I mean, I wrote a short biography of her. She's on my mind, and I'm actually working on her again at the moment, because I can sort of summon her up at any moment as to what she was thinking or doing. I mean, I read all her letters. I mean, I spent a year working on just reading in New York Public Library her stuff, and then afterwards continuing to write about her and all that. That lovely idea, which I suppose Freud gave us so beautifully, that when someone's telling you a story, you wonder, oh, the story is interesting, but the person telling it, why are they telling it? What is behind the story? What's not being said? And so I looked at the story and realized that it was possibly, certainly in my version of it, the reason she told him the story was that she needed somehow to discuss adultery some evening over dinner. Chelsea couldn't discuss her own. I mean, after all, it was 1893 and she was a dowager. But actually, she was basically sending a message to herself almost, or somehow getting through the evening by saying something that was almost true.
When you're working on nonfiction, does this idea of moving off into fiction, taking material that you're working on as a critic slash journalist, and suddenly going, hey, I can riff on this, does that come up a lot?
No, it doesn't really come up a lot. I mean, the useful thing for me for reviewing, say, or writing nonfiction is thinking. Trying to make sense of something in a narrative which requires thought, and that you consider everything before you write it down, and you try and make it seem as though it is the most intelligent thing you could think at the time. And that's very useful if you put it against a sort of wildness that you could have when you're writing fiction, where any image can come in, where anything can occur, and where one hits against the other. I mean, I think Brooklyn, say, is a very deliberate novel in the way it's plotted and planned. And I don't think it could have happened without those two things being there. First of all, giving someone who isn't me, or isn't even a version of me, a full life, and letting her have thoughts and letting her have sensations and things happening to her, but at the same time trying to control that into a narrative, trying to be thoughtful about it, as well as trying to let it happen with the full degree of life in it.
Brooklyn today is nothing like the Brooklyn of Brooklyn. The buildings are the same, but Brooklyn itself is different, and it struck me as being as alien to me as Ireland in the time.
Yeah, I didn't do that much research. And in fact, there's an interesting review by Pete Hamill, who knew Brooklyn in those years, saying, you know, really, 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 there's very little of Brooklyn of the 50s in this book. That's almost deliberate. In fact, it is deliberate. That she didn't notice Brooklyn. She noticed the room she was sleeping in, boarding house itself, the place she worked in, and a dance hall, and a church, and the boyfriend's house, and the boyfriend. The rest of Brooklyn seemed cold, alien, and strange, and she didn't see it. So, I mean, I read a few books on Brooklyn. Oh, yeah, she goes to a baseball game, and she goes to Coney Island. But the actual flavor of Brooklyn for someone who was from Brooklyn is missing in the book, because she has arrived there, and she simply doesn't see it.
Well, I guess that's also true for a lot of immigrants who live within their own circle as well, is that they never step outside of it either.
Yeah, I think that would be true now for a Russian arriving in Brooklyn, that they would notice all the Russians, and they'd notice where they lived, and they'd have a restaurant maybe, or a place they worked. But the idea of, say, the Brooklyn of Jonathan Lethem, or the Brooklyn of Paul Auster, it simply wouldn't occur to them. I did enjoy putting the title Brooklyn on the book, because it's a dull Brooklyn of the 50s, whereas it's not the Williamsburg of now.
Colm Tobin, I'd like to talk a little bit about Love in a Dark Time, which is an exploration of artists dealing with homosexuality. I noticed, and we were talking about this before the air because it was very striking, the idea that 1984 is an allegory of gay life, whereas Orwell was straight and all of his critics were straight, and no one caught it until you read about it and just riffed on it.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's more that if you say in a society, oh, listen, you know, we'll deal with homosexual freedom later, but now we want to deal with, you know, full democracy, say in an emerging society, you say to someone, in 1984, what they are forbidden. They're forbidden to love each other. And that is considered by Orwell, and the reader believes it, to be the largest punishment available for two people. And you think, okay. I mean, obviously it didn't occur to Orwell that just in front of his nose in England, this was happening. That this was happening all around him. And that this has happened in every country in the world in some way or other in our time. Especially when you're sort of my age, you know, and you come from somewhere like Ireland where the law wasn't changed until 94. I mean, they didn't enforce it, but it was there. That the idea that two men could love each other and should be allowed to do so in every possible way, and should be, in fact, encouraged to do so, was not there when I was growing up. That, therefore, you were offering an image to young people who, say, were gay, that you cannot love, your love does not equal ours. I was certainly concerned about this, and it's an argument you have to make in Ireland quite a lot, to say, actually, if you think as a straight person, as a politician who's a straight person, as a lawmaker, that my love could not equal yours, on what basis do you say so? I'm afraid you get a great silence on the other side. I mean, are you sure you're not operating from vile prejudice? And if you are, surely that's very, very wrong of you. But the Orwell thing is interesting in that that is what they are forbidden from doing in 1984, from loving each other.
When you went to Barcelona, was part of that to just get away from that kind of...
No, it was much more drift. It would be lovely to say, oh yes, Ireland was so repressive that I left and went to Spain where it wasn't so repressive. But I just drifted into Spain, and it was a big shock. I got it all mixed up. I wasn't sure really whether I was so excited about the arrival of democracy or so many beautiful people or the absolute freedom. You know, there was one gay bar in Barcelona in 1975, and no one went to it. But the streets were cruising grounds of the most extraordinary sort. I mean, you couldn't go down the Ramblas, which was the main street, or any of the streets around it. Even if you were thinking about something else, you'd end up just seeing someone beautiful. And I was 20 years old and, you know, pretty exotic looking myself because, you know, I had a big beard and stuff. So I drifted into it.
At what point in terms of your going did Franco die and did everything change or had it change?
I went in September 75 and he died in November 75. Some things did change. In other words, the democratic procedures were put in place, and that obviously made a difference. It copper fastened certain things, and it gave people certain freedoms. But within people themselves, especially in Catalonia, which is in a way a more advanced society than, perhaps because of the amount of tourism or its closeness to France, people were already free of Franco, I would think, 6 or 7 years before he died. So his death wasn't the moment. The arrival of long hair, the arrival of marijuana, the arrival of Bob Dylan, these things, I think, mattered more in creating what was a huge generation gap. That a lot of people, when I went there in 75, really were quite separated from their parents. Which is in one of the stories where people just felt, you know, you settled down under a dictator, you made money, you made life ordinary under this monster. Which, of course, when you think about it, is of course what they did. But if you were their children, that act looked atrocious in a certain light, especially in the light of subsequent, you know, events and the arrival of democracy.
In that context, Carmé's attitude toward her parents, giving them the finger in a way, up and down the line.
In that story in particular, you know, her rage against them is elemental. And you're talking about that idea in a country of pure bourgeois gracelessness of the parents, of their prejudices and of their sitting around, you know, having made all this money and their daughter coming back. And it's that business having been away for 10 years. If she'd lived with it for 10 years, she too would have become in some way part of it. But coming from away, it made her very, very brittle and very open to just judging them rather than, say, loving them.
Well, at the same time, the mother locks the refrigerator.
It was an image that I had in my mind for years and years of a girl and her boyfriend coming down half-dressed in the middle of the night, having been making love through the night, just because they're hungry, to find that the mother has actually put a rusty chain around the refrigerator. I have no idea where it comes from. I just loved the idea. And of the boyfriend kicking the fridge. That has been on my mind for so long, I wanted to get it in somewhere.
Colm Tobin, you've written one play and you're working on another. How do you compare the difference? You've talked a little about the difference between working on a novel and working on the short stories. How do you compare the difference between working on a play and those other two forms?
I think in Ireland in the last 30 years, what's been happening in the theatre has been really dynamic and interesting. And you can't escape it. The plays of Brian Friel or Tom Murphy, Sebastian Vimery. I mean, you could keep naming them. And they become a way of life in the city, of knowing a lot of actors and of being there, you know, when those plays are being performed for the first time. It's fresh work.
And McDonagh's.
And, I mean, I was there in Galway when the very first opening night, when Martin McDonagh was a 22-year-old boy and the Beauty Queen of Leenane opened in the theatre. I was in the theatre that night. That's how you live in Ireland, you know, and these plays nourish the society. They have a fundamental relationship with the society. It's not merely if you have a lot of money and you go out on a night of entertainment. It doesn't feel like that in the Irish theatre. So I wrote one, and it was fine. It lasted 4 weeks. I mean, it's funny the way it's over, and you become very fond of the actors. And it's much more fun than writing novels or stories because you get to go down in the evening. You know, even if you don't go into the performance, what I used to love was going to the bar opposite and being in the bar at the counter when the actors came in one by one and buying them a drink and just helping them to come down from their excitement and just loving that. The new one is a monologue for an actress. So that when I was working on it, I was hearing a voice. I was working with an idea of a voice. The words were coming out in that way so that I was, you know, offering them to an actual living voice rather than the silence of the reader. And we'll see what happens with it. I mean, it's going to be performed in October. I have to go into a workshop for a week with the actress and just see how, I mean, we have to get it right before we start. So there's a bit more work to be done. I have to work for a week and then maybe write for a few weeks more.
Because it's a monologue, it could also be a first-person short story.
Yeah, and I'll publish it then. I mean, I have a much longer version of it that I'll publish, and then the shorter version, because with a monologue, we don't want an interval, so it'll be, you can't really keep people in the theatre more than an hour and a half.
Colm Tobin, have you ever thought about working on a film?
They made a film of the novel The Blackwater Lightship, and it was sort of fascinating, because Angela Lansbury played the leading part, and Diane Weist, the Woody Allen actress, you know, or anyway, she's worked a lot with Woody Allen, played the mother, you know. It arrived by FedEx on a Monday morning, and I had a new machine, and I wondered, I thought, I won't watch this for a while, I'm not sure I'm able for this, but I put it in just to see if the new machine would take an American DVD, and I started watching it, and it was very powerful. It was made by Hallmark. It was made by a director called John Erman, who made this film called An Early Frost. Yeah. It's the first film about AIDS, you know, and John was a great director, and the cast was amazing. But one of the things that John had that I didn't have is that you could add music. In a novel, you can't add music. You can't just press a button on the page and music comes up. In a film, you can do that so that you can actually manipulate emotion, which I was very interested in, and including mine, even though I'd written it, the music could do that for me. And it would give me a key to how to feel. And I was very interested in that idea. Couldn't adapt it myself, however, to novels. Brooklyn is being adapted by Nick Hornby for the screen. I'd be interested to see what he does with it. I mean, I think he's really talented, and I really wanted him. And I didn't want to do it myself, because I think if you do it yourself, I didn't do the Blackwater Lightship myself either, you end up becoming protective of your own structures and of your own emotions, and you just end up doing the same thing twice. Whereas if you hand it over to somebody, and you hand it over freely and easily, something can occur where that person's interpretation of it can become very interesting in a way that your interpretation would not be interesting.
I'd like you to talk about a quote from the National Post in terms of your collection, The Empty Family. I suppose in every story, in some way or other, there is at the core of things a sense of society, a community, or a family. That has been emptied of its core, and what's left is the single individual, and that single individual is at the center of the drama. Do you think that is an overlying feeling about all of your work, or just these stories and your own recent past?
Oh, I think it's been there for some time. It's certainly there in The Master, the novel about Henry James, the idea of James having to fill himself almost as an empty vessel, having escaped somehow family, having to sort of work alone. And that out of that, then, he managed to produce a sort of set of masterpieces, which he felt if he'd had a family, I mean, if he'd had kids and a wife or something, he wouldn't have been able to do in the same way. I'm not just talking about homosexuality as a metaphor or even as a thing, because I don't think that's the issue. The issue is that it's easier for me to dramatize the lives of certain souls who seem to have been cast out, who are alone, who have to make things up as they go along emotionally and in other ways, even domestically. And so that's been there. It's there in Brooklyn. It's there in The Master. It's there in, I think, all the stories in Mothers and Sons, the previous book, and it's there in this book again. So, yeah, it's become my subject. I'd like to get a new one soon. I mean, I'd like to feel that there was one more subject to come my way. But you can work with it in that you can give the person then a sort of stark psychology, an experience can come to them. And they're very good at avoiding emotion or at being pleased when certain things that other people would want desperately don't come to them, seeming to feel an almost warmth about that. And they're skilled also, which is something you can explore, I think, very well in fiction, is they're skilled at presenting something to the world that isn't real, that the interior is a different thing. And so the reader becomes acutely aware of this shell of somebody who seems in full control in the world, and the interior part is not like that at all. And so the novel can work with that in a way that the drama can't, or film can't, or poetry can't, that the novel can constantly work with that, because you can work with people's thoughts and memories and feelings as well as what they're saying and doing.
And that if you try to do that, you can only come up with, I guess, a metaphor for doing it. You can't actually just do it in film or in drama, because it's only what you see.
I think in drama you can suggest it, but in a novel you can actually enact it.
If there's anything that takes one away from The Empty Family, it's the closing of the last story, The Street, because Malik gets a family.
Yeah, I wanted to be careful about a sort of overdetermined bleakness, which could look like a philosophy of some sort, which is sort of fatal to fiction, because you need fiction to be open to any wind that blows rather than to a set of predetermined ideas. So I wanted some opening to occur, some light to be switched on at the end of the book, that you felt, actually, this is pure, and this is almost happiness. And even though they're merely brushing against each other in the public arena, nonetheless, that public space of two men going for a walk on the day off is an image I was working towards. Two ordinary guys who have, you know, badly paid jobs, who live in a place that isn't great, who have everyone against them, can go for a walk, and on the way back from the walk just brush against each other, just knowing what that means. And that actually stands for an awful lot.
Colm Tobin, I understand you're working on another novel.
Yeah, I've been working on a novel, and I have 5 chapters written. And I have, I think, what do I have? I have 2 new stories written as well. So that's not too bad.
You've been listening to an interview with Colm Tobin, whose latest collection of short stories, The Empty Family, and I guess Brooklyn, is just out in trade paper?
Yeah, it's been out for a while, I think, in trade paper, yeah.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.